John Bernard, I want to just make a short comment. The funeral that was announced for Mr. Bernard. He's a remarkable man, and many of you know him from over the years as he traveled all through the region and all the activities and, you know, thousands upon thousands of miles as he went. But I remember visiting with him one day down in Lewiston, and he was describing, he was in World War II, and he was at Pearl Harbor. And so I began to ask him, you know, well, tell me a little bit about that. And he was part of the military police. And if I remember right, was not the Arizona moored on Ford Island, was it not an island? Well, he had their military police post was on Ford Island. And as the attack started, they jumped in the back of a pickup, and they're taking the military police out away from the dockside and to get him out into position somewhere. And he's in the back of the truck, and he says, I was watching the Arizona when it blew up. Now, that is just incredible to talk to somebody who could describe for you the actual explosion and what it looked like and how that impacted him. So I used to, when I was down in Lewiston, I would always go visit with John, and just a wonderful, faithful, incredible person. And I can just say I'm grateful for the impact that he's had on many of our lives. He was working in the logging industry when he was, I think, 70, hauling his saw up and down, cutting down trees. I mean, it's just a remarkable individual, full of fire. On the 10th of September, 2001, Michelle and I went to sleep in a hotel room in Portland, and Rock Corbett called the next morning early, September 11th, 2001, woke us up and said, you need to see what's on TV. And we woke up in one day, overnight, and the world had fundamentally changed. It was a regional conference, ministerial conference. The rest of the conference was canceled. We had flown in and we had to be driven home. The Clarks drove us home and brought us all the way back up to Spokane because there was no way at that point. All the planes were grounded. It was hard to believe at that time that the world could change that quickly. You were in class. You were having a good time. You were with friends. You go to bed. You wake up in the morning and the world has changed. One day you're living your life, hopefully in a very productive manner. I'm speaking about us. I'm not speaking about just anyone. You're living your life in a productive manner, but the next day everything changed. The fact is, we don't always get to finish what we're doing. And we have to ask ourselves the question, is what we have done up to this point enough? Is it enough? Deborah Collins died unexpectedly on the Day of Atonement this year. I'd been down to visit her a little bit before, and she is taking some medication for some illness and disease that she was doing battle with, and it kind of makes you drowsy, and she was in a sweat lodge, a heated environment, and she apparently went to sleep and never woke up. Getting ready to go to the feast, travel with her family. You know, I like Deborah very much. She'd been up here in Spokane a little bit, mostly down in the Pendleton area and over to Kennewick. But, you know, at some point in our lives, you say, again, is what we have done up to this moment enough? Because we don't always get to finish what we're doing. This last week, I was down, this last couple weeks, couple months, according to Mike. I was at the Challenger 2 program in Tucson. We were camped on Mount Lemmon. They have a book about climbing all the climbs. It's called Squeezing the Lemon. And so the Mount Lemmon has, well, it just has literally thousands of climbs, bolted, routes planned out, pictured in a book, rated. You can climb forever, it would seem. It's just an incredible area. But we had our camp up on Mount Lemmon, about 10 young adults, and we had anywhere from 9 to 12 staff members because it depends on who was working that day or in what function. And a couple of the men from the congregation there came up and they had bought their own cameras and they had their own computers and they had their own gear and they were running a whole camera operation and they're filming and editing and they produced a DVD of the program that we had done, and they hadn't quite finished it when we left, so they were going to mail it to us. I came home with a demo of the DVD, and I had about a half hour on it, but you know, we just had a lot of people contributing in different ways. Because we were camped up there, you didn't even have cell phone access. We didn't even hear about the damage from that tsunami and the earthquake for a couple of days. And when we heard it, it sounded very dramatic, but we really didn't know what had taken place. And as we broke camp and bailed out of there, honestly, I don't think it was until I was sitting in the airport at Salt Lake City on the way home that I finally stopped and said, okay, I know there's a crisis, I see the headlines, it's bad, but just what has taken place? And I'm watching Fox News, and they're running video clips of the waves, of the damage, of people, of the survivors. And I had about 45 minutes there before my plane took off, and I was kind of wishing that I could just stand there and see what indeed was taking place. All of a sudden, I could more grasp the fact that for all these people, you know, for all these people, all of a sudden they had to ask themselves, or maybe they didn't get to ask themselves, was it enough? Did I do what I needed to do when I could? They showed in an interview of a lady who had two children with her, and they were down on the lower floor below the hotel when the water came in. The husband was up in the room and could actually see him, was looking at him, and the water came in, and she's holding on to two little children. And they began to all go under together, and she couldn't fight to save either one. And so she said, I had to decide which one to let go. Can you? I can't imagine. She said, I had to decide which one to let go. And one child couldn't swim at all. I don't know, it was maybe too small. And one child maybe could paddle a little. And she let his hand go. And she grabbed the other and tried to fight her way back to the surface, or to hold on and balance herself and hang on to something to save the one. That was a very nice presentation, because they found the other child a few hours later. But how do you make such a choice as that? And so all of a sudden, it kind of just descended on me what an incredible, terrible thing had taken place. But out of a moment, just out of a moment's notice. And frankly, people then had to ask themselves, and many couldn't, they were dead, had I done enough? Because that was it. It was over. There was no way to go back and do it all again. That family, the husband watching from the balcony, the mother now with the one child and one restored to her, you know, I imagine that there's going to be a major assessment in their life. I just can't believe that there would not be, and they will surely ask themselves, is there anything at all that we have left undone? I have to believe that question is going to run through their mind. Sermon I gave way back when I used to attend up here, on Let There Be Light. I referenced the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. And the parable says that while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And it's been very easy for us to look at, say, the end time church, and we relate that to the spiritual condition, and we say the whole church slumbered and slept. I was going back through that, and I began to wonder, is that really the point? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. You know, there certainly has been an apostasy in the Church of God. I think that would be very hard to deny. There certainly is a problem of being caught up in the world, of buying into this world's values, of being affected by what goes on around us to too great of a degree. That's true. But how wise are the people who have done that? Did the wise fall away from the truth? Did the wise buy into the ways of this world? Those things sound kind of foolish to me. They don't sound wise at all. The wise virgins went out to meet the bridegroom, and they took plenty of oil. They rested, but they were still ready when he came, and they did go on to the wedding. They did what they needed to do, but others did not. Have we done what we need to do? Have we done at this moment in time, have we prepared ourselves the way we needed to prepare? Are we ready right now to fulfill our calling? Are we ready right now in doing the work? You see, you don't get to finish everything you set your hand to do. We have to make choices. And sometimes life makes choices for us. Sometimes it seems like time goes on forever, but the reality is, for some people, time is cut very, very short. Look at Romans chapter 9. This is in the context of Israel denying Jesus Christ, the Gentiles being called in to replace those who indeed were not responsive to God. And God calls that His work. His work is to call people into the body of Christ and prepare them for the kingdom of God. Romans 9, verse number 27. Isaiah also cries out concerning Israel, "Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved." But notice verse 28. "For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will make a short work upon the earth." We look at our lives as a long work. God says he'll make a short work. But what he's saying is, when it comes time to finish it, to wrap it up, he says he's going to cut it short in righteousness for good purpose. So while it seems like life just goes on and continues indefinitely, the fact is the time's going to come when it's like that tidal wave, or it's like that car wreck, or it's like, you know, that mistake with the medicine. The time comes when the time is up. And God says, in the end, in the finish, I'm going to cut it short, and it will be over. And the people will have to ask themselves, did I do what I needed to? You just don't get to work forever. We don't have all time. We don't have all options. John chapter 9, verse number 1. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. His disciples asked him and said, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him." So Christ says, look, I'm busy. And there's certain things I have to do, and I have to do them within a time frame of what's allowed. And he answers that in response in verse 4, "I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work." So he says, I know I have limited time, that time doesn't run on forever, and these things must be accomplished. Have we done what we needed to do? We had a discussion every night at camp. We had a compass check in the morning. The compass check lasted 30 minutes. And we would illustrate examples of leadership, and then we would say, okay, now we want to apply this today. We want to apply these lessons. We want to discuss these things and think about these today. And then we went out. Every day we climbed on a different set of rocks, different shapes, sizes. We had the highest climbs at 90 feet. 90 feet. The toughest climbs that were actually accomplished and finished were 5'9"s. I don't know that that means much to a lot of us. But if you're around rock climbing, 5'9", basically, if you're going to do big wall climbing in Yosemite and you're going to climb thousands of feet in the open, they say that you should be able to climb 5'10"s repeatedly. Well, I guess Yosemite's out for me. But the staff who climb recreationally in various ways, and some of the best of those that were in the program, could get up and finish those 5'9"s, and some of those will be going on and doing those 5'10"s. Some of the 5'10 climbs we started, and we would work some of the system, but we wouldn't be able to complete the whole to the finish. But we would climb through the day like that, rappel down certain sections, climb others, come back, and in the evening we would have a compass check. Excuse me. We would have Christian living in the evening. In the evening, Christian living was 1 to 2 hours around the fire. Again, presentation, leadership, spiritual examples, and then a discussion. How do we apply this to our lives? You know what one of the questions was that came up? One of the questions was, why do some of the young adults in the church avoid baptism? Why does baptism keep sliding into the future? And you know what the answer was? Or at least that was given. There's probably many answers. But the answer given was, well, some people just want to leave their options open. Some people don't want to draw the final line. Because they look at that line as the point of accountability, and that means you're absolutely committed and there's no going back. And as long as the options are kind of open, then it's not like we have to really face all of those things at this moment in time. But you want to know what the reality is? You're accountable for what you understand. I talked with someone one time, and he says, well, explain the plan of God to me. So I explained the resurrections and the plan of God. And he says, that's good. I think I'll take the second resurrection. And I was looking at, and I looked at him and I says, you know, if you know enough to say that, you probably know too much. If you know enough to choose the second resurrection, you probably know enough to be accountable to the first. Now that person eventually, again, came in, was baptized, and he doesn't ask those kind of questions anymore. But it was an interesting discussion. Well, you know, it's kind of like this concept of keeping your options open. You're not absolutely, totally, without fail, committed. Well, that's fine. But if God is working with you and you understand these things, then maybe you just haven't done what you needed to do. Maybe you just haven't done enough. Don't get in any car wrecks. You know, don't stand in front of any earthquakes or tidal waves or fall off any rocks or get sick. Because that's just not the way it works. Challenger 2 program was what they call a beta program. It's kind of like a beta computer program. They set it out and see if it works. And you test it and give your input on it, and then you send all your input in, and then they analyze what they're going to do in the future. That's what it was. It was a first run. One venue, just one activity, everybody working together to do one thing, and it was scheduled during the winter break, so it's offset from camps. Because the individuals who go through it now can go and be staff at any rock climbing program at any camp that, at least that we function with, and I'm sure that anybody else does if they had a chance to interview and be considered. They were trained and they are ready. They are now effectively staff. We wanted to take young adults. This was not a salvage operation. You know, this was a group of young adults who were already involved and already motivated. The highest caliber in that sense that we could find, we wanted to take them a little further. Bring them along and keep them on that way. The youngest was 18. The oldest was 26. The person who came away, who traveled the furthest to get there, was from Florida, flying in. So it wasn't like everybody just local in the area. It wasn't just a matter of convenience. 4 out of the 10 had been to ABC. One was on his way when camp was closed to go back and begin. 3 of the 10 had been to Thailand with the project that was there, the Sextons run and manage. One had lived in Europe. Now, just because someone lived in Europe doesn't make them somehow special, but it gives a different perspective. It's education. It's history. The majority of them were either vocalists or musicians. One had played the fiddle, he said, for 13 years. He was only 18. Start out, you know, classical violin and moves into the fiddle. And we said, don't you ever come back here without that instrument. Can you imagine how much fun we could have had with him fiddling, you know, and running, jumping up and down the campfire and throwing holly leaves in the air or something, you know, over Christmas. But it was incredible. One was his class president. Two had maxed the SAT test when they took it. Two. 1,600 points. Totally maxed out the score. Two of them. You know, I thought, you know how much you'd have to know to get all those points? No matter what they asked you, you had it? One said he was weak in vocabulary, so he just took and wrote all these vocabulary words on these cards and he carried them around probably for months just going through vocabulary words because that was his weakness. He says math, that was a breeze. He knew his math. But he didn't know his vocabulary, and so he had to learn words that I probably never even heard. I think I got a 420 when I took the SAT. One was a teacher. Already, you know, fully employed as a teacher. This is the break for her as well, and it gave her that opportunity to come in. One of the climbers, we didn't call them campers because that's kind of like summer camp. That's the teens. So we call them climbers because they were in a little different category. They were older, and indeed, they were training to be staff. One flew home. We broke camp a Wednesday morning in the rain, pouring rain. Everything's wet, soggy. And one got up real early and, frankly, had broken camp and was out the door and gone before I even got up. You know, got up at noon, but... he had to get back home to go to work. And if he flew home, which he flew out from there and got home, he could get in time to go to work a little late through the morning, but he could get to work. He could run a little late in the day. He could get in a full day's work and pay for the entire plane flight of the trip because he's a very capable and successful young man, and that's simply the profession he's in and the ability he has to produce. So he had to get home, get that day's work, and cover the cost of his trip. Yeah, it was a... incredible opportunity to be there with them. They did breakfast prep and cleanup. They made the lunches. They did dinner prep and cleanup. And they went through every day and checked the gear. This wasn't something where everything was done for them. This is where they had to learn to do for themselves. In climbing, we started out belaying them, and by the end of the program, they belayed themselves. It was a great job. We'd be back there drinking Mai Tais and watching them climb on the rocks. But we trained them to run the camp themselves. Again, this was a type of program. What do we want to do? And you know what? When the feedback came back, I was reading it this morning as they begin to send their feedback. The reviews on the program and how it was structured was just very, very positive. But the one consistent thing they said was, you know, we would like it to be a little tougher. You know, a little tougher. You know, we actually had a campground with a toilet. A toilet. Now, there was no running water, but we brought water up, and we had some very industrious people. We had a man got up there and brought up his camper that you pull behind the pickup, and he had it there because he's working, and we weren't using that, but he brought his little generator and kicked it out and ran a cord and hung lights around the arena in the middle where you could sit, so we had lights at night, you know, and they said, you know, maybe a little more in the wilderness next time. They wanted to learn a little more. They didn't want to have it a little easier, and it was incredible. Again and again, they said, well, let's, you know, I mean, it was one night there, a couple nights it dropped into the 20s. And the wind was blowing. Now, I'm telling you, it was cold. I had two fleeces, sweatshirt, a down coat, and I looked like Stumbo or somebody. I got pictures on the DVD, I'm just balloon, you know, like this. But boy, I tell you, I was comfortable. But it was an incredible group. We were their teachers, but we were teaching them to be teachers as well. Isn't that what God is doing? Aren't we the staff? Aren't we the ones that He's working through? We do the cleanup and the prep. We put together the lunches. And then we put everything to bed when it's done. That's what we do. So He's teaching us to be teachers. To what degree have we fulfilled that? Have we? At this point in time. How much of that is already in place? What is left to be done? Because how in the world do we know what our opportunities are going to be? I was taught in college to always carry a sermonette in the back of my Bible. That's what I was taught in college. Now, I wasn't going into the ministry back then. I wanted a life of adventure. I'm going to see if there aren't some more camps out there somewhere. Just joking. I never used my sermonette. I put one in the back of my Bible. I never used it. You know, life's not fair. I had friends who never bothered putting one in the back of their Bible, and they'd go to Fiji for the feast, and they'd be asked to speak. I'd kind of stand up and go, "Hi, I went to Ambassador. I'm ready," and they just laugh. But I was there. I was ready. I prepared it. God still used me, just used me in another way. Maybe a little later on, a little different way. One of the participants there at the program that had been to Thailand said, now, the oldest one's 26, and he wasn't the oldest, so let's just say he's probably in his early 20s. He'd be right in the middle there somewhere. But when he went to Thailand, they wanted him to go out and visit some of the small groups of people that are scattered, the brethren that are there. And you know what he ended up having to do? Take the sermon. So he's out there, 21 or 2 or whatever, he's giving the sermons on the Sabbath when he goes out to visit. Well, okay, that's a unique environment. But it happened. And he had to come up and fulfill that, and that doesn't mean when he goes back home to his local congregation that he's given the sermon today, but you don't know that he won't be used in some way as a result. But it wasn't because he said, you know what, I'll tell you what, I'm going to think about getting ready to do that. The point is not to give sermons. That's not the issue. That is a issue. There's many ways in which God requires of us our service. But we don't need to always be thinking, I'm going to be ready for that someday. Because there won't always be the opportunity to finish what we have begun. What will God use us to do? Will He use us to teach if we haven't studied? Will we be an example if we don't understand? Right here in Post Falls, some of the young adults help with Sabbath school. Some of the young adults lead songs. You run the sports programs. If you weren't running the sports programs right now, we wouldn't have sports programs. I do hope we're thinking about gyms for basketball. You help run the sound system and back up on the cybercast, and when Alan Hurst is taking his days off, the cybercast goes on. Backed himself up, trained his own family to run behind him. Some are working with that winter family weekend and planning the activities and working on the dance and preparing for the skiing up on the hill, and some are organizing the backpacking trip as it comes up in the summer. And honestly, again, if those things weren't being done that way, they would not be accomplished. There are many hands, and again, I'm focusing on the group that we were working with, trying to transition them into leadership, but the fact is they're already in leadership. We're just trying to help them along their way. John Lafferty mentioned, John, are we short on cleanup chairs when we run our crews? Are we making way, or are we... All right, so there's a little plug right there, Maybe where we need to help the most is just cleaning up the chairs. Like I said, down at the camp, they set up and they cleaned up after themselves and each other, and we ran the camp in that way. Are we prepared to serve and lead now? And if not, what else needs to be done? And if it needs to be done, when will it be done? Is it always going to be in the future? Sure, I'll get baptized someday. I will commit someday. Well, what if someday doesn't work out? What if you don't get to finish what you started? You can say, well, God finishes what He starts, fine. But we need to finish what we start in 1,000 ways. John 15, verse number 16. You did not choose me, I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, He will give to you. You've committed yourself, you're dedicated, you're invested and involved, and God is going to honor and bless that. But the fruitfulness here comes first And he says, so that whatever you ask me, I'll give you. I will back you up. I will make your hand even more fruitful indeed. 1 John 3:16. Same John, just different book. 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we ought also to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Do what's right, but do it. Don't think about doing it. Don't talk about doing it. Don't be waiting to do it. Do it. But do what's right. I told the climbers at the camp that it really didn't matter that they knew how to belay. It only mattered, really, that they did it and they did it right. I don't want to be up on the rope and have somebody say, you know, I really do understand now what I need to do. No, I want you to do what you need to do, because it's my life that's at stake. I'm on your rope. Who's on your rope? How many people do we carry? Can we carry? Are we willing to carry? God didn't call us just so that we would know the truth. He called us so that we would do it. Not talk about it, not think about it or wish about it, but do it. Hebrews 10, verse 24, ties into this very same thing. Very short principle, not trying to address the whole context here. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. Stir up love and good works. The word good here means virtuous or noble. It's bigger than just doing what's right. It's actually doing the highest thing or the best thing. It's not the minimum, it's the most. Success is sometimes defined as preparation meeting opportunity. Preparation has to be already in place. Opportunity arrives, and success is the fact that you're ready to go. But that opportunity may not indeed be what we think. I have a copy of Outside Magazine with me today, which I used for an illustration at the camp. I don't recommend Outside Magazine. It has a tendency to be a little crass, frankly, but there are some articles in here that are very helpful and useful to me. Inside, they had a very short clip on Hugh Glass. Has anyone here even heard of Hugh Glass? Trapper. Let me read this to you. In 1823, Glass signed on with a crew of trappers. I used this as one of our compass checks, and then made some illustrations with it in terms of why I wanted this addressed. Glass signed on with a crew of trappers, headed up the Missouri River to Fort Henry in southwestern Montana. Halfway to their destination, Glass, who was about 40, was tracking game when he stumbled on a mother grizzly and her two cubs. The bear reared up and dug her teeth into him, ripping off huge chunks of his flesh. He didn't just get bit up a little bit, he got tore up. His companions came down the pass, shot the 6-foot bear through the skull, and the animal collapsed on Glass. The hunters, thinking there was no way the man could live through the night, made him a bed out of buffalo hide and waited for him to die. The next morning, Glass was still breathing. The mission leader, Major Andrew Henry, decided that the trappers needed to move out of the hostile Indian territory, and he paid two men to stay with Glass in his final hours, to be there with him until he died. But he held on, and after 3 days, the men abandoned the unconscious trapper, taking with them his knife and gun. They thought he was a dead man, and they figured if they hung around that they would be dead men as well. He was unconscious, and they took the knife and gun and left. Glass awoke, and he found himself alone and unable to walk. He began to crawl the 100 miles back to Fort Kiowa through the heart of the Arikara country, the Indian country. Inch by inch, Glass who as a young man had learned from the Pawnee Indians how to live off the land, dragged himself through the scrub, getting strength by eating wild fruit and meat from the carcass of a buffalo calf killed by the wolves. After 6 months, he stumbled into Fort Kiowa and resumed life as a trapper. Now, you can say, oh, anybody could do that, you know. You know, 75-year-old lady climbs Rainier and a blind man climbs Everest, you know, so we ought to be able to eat broken glass and survive. But fact is, it says he had done in his youth and prepared in these things, and he learned how to live off the land. Now that's preparation meeting opportunity. Not opportunity you want, but opportunity to exercise the preparation. And he lived. 6 months, he crawled 100 miles back to the fort, eating berries and dead animals on the way. And the question I asked myself, where does that will come from? Never say die. Where does that come from? Never quit. And so through that day, as people climbed, and they would get to that point to where your arms were tired and your legs are shaking and you just want to fall off the rock, and we would say, now hold it. Are you really spent, or can you go on? And when we would talk to them, and they would say, well, okay, I guess it's not over yet. And some of the climbers finished climbs that they were ready to fall off of because they quite frankly just weren't mentally ready to pay that price until they thought about it. And they said, you know, I can still do this. But I always thought, that is such an incredible story. He crawled out of there and he survived. Current U.S. news. All is stacked up as I come home from my months-long vacation. Current U.S. news, 50 ways to improve your life. On the inside, they actually said it a little more strongly. It says 50 ways to fix your life. So they kind of hook you in and then they tell you, look, you know, we're going to address the real thing. First 10 ways. Simplify your life. What do you think? They've been reading some old literature or something? I mean, have you ever heard that before? Simplify your life? The first 10 of the 50, it says simplify. I want to just address a little bit in a framework of some of what they were saying. It says you need to know where you're headed. If you're too busy, it's hard to choose that path. It says cut back. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Cut back enough to focus to make sure that you know where you're going. I thought, well, that's an interesting concept. Night before I left for Challenger Camp, I went to bed at 1 o'clock. Got up at 2. And I thought, you know, this is really getting old. Or maybe I'm really getting old, but these old one-hour naps, they're just not what they used to be. Later that night, I flew into Phoenix and then drove over from Phoenix, but I'm sitting with my cousin and his wife. We're sitting there at dinner, after dinner, and I'm sitting at the table, and I'm actually going to sleep talking to him. My eyes are closed, my head's, and so they sent me off to bed, and I don't know, I probably went to bed at 9, got up at 9, and I don't think I've done that in, you know, 126 years. I worked for a minister one time who started to fall asleep during the sermon. I thought, how in the world can you do that? He's up there speaking. Now, he kept speaking, and there must have been kind of an autopilot or something on. And then you can see his eyes start to close, and his head's bobbing, but he keeps speaking like this. And I'm going, man, I'm waiting for him to fall right off of there. And then he kind of catches himself, and he goes right on. I thought, that's impressive, you know. I want to be like that. So I'm thinking all during camp, you know, I need to boil things down just a little bit temporarily here and try to assess that I'm actually on track the way I need to be and not just bumping into things. So John came up and asked me if he said, you know, there's no Bible studies listed on the on the bulletin, or, well, he said, is there a Bible study this week? And I go, isn't that amazing? There's no Bible studies listed on the bulletin. I told Bonnie, don't list them. And if I ever feel like giving one again, I'll announce it. Simplify your life. So, what I'm going to try, I'm just going to try taking January, and at this point, I just need a little time to catch up, read the mail, you know, answer some letters. I came home, there's like 125 requests for the index when I came home. When I left, there was none. Now, that's not all one by one. That's, you know, one pastor transfers and he wants to get a box, and then there's another someone that's a group of about 20, and then a whole bunch of single stuff. But there's a bunch, and I'm out. I gave them all away, passed them all out, so I wasn't thinking, you know, there would be that kind of need for that, so I've got to stop and maybe print some. But I got to talk. I'm talking to Alan and, you know, complaining to him about things, and it's been suggested that, well, why don't you just take that index and make the PDF file? This has been suggested from day one. I've steadfastly refused. Make it a PDF file and stick it on the website, and then that's their problem. You know, they can print it off and set it up formatted where they can take it down to Kinko's and have it laid out and make their own book and pay for their own binding and save all that effort. And I thought, okay. So what I'll probably do now, not because I'm smart, but because I don't have any choice, I still would like to finish the update, but we can never afford to give that away and replace the 2,300 and going up now that are already out there. So probably we'll do the update, maybe stretch it out a little bit, take a little more time, and then when it is ready, put it on the website, and you're on your own. And then you and I can have one that's nice. But we won't tell anybody. Cover the microphone. So anyway, you know, I need to make a few visits. I need to get out and get a few things done. So what I'll do is when I can kind of get a little caught up and my life is simplified, then I'll go ahead and we'll fire back up the Bible studies and we'll see which way we want to go. If we want to go back into the ABC classes or continue on the subjects as we have. But I just wanted to mention that going through. Numbers 11 through 16. On U.S. News said to stimulate. You know, they picked one word thing, stimulate yourself. So the tired mind isn't a happy mind. Ask my wife. Do I get happier when I'm more tired? I don't think so. It says use different parts of your brain in unexpected ways. Do something that's using the dead part of your brain. You know, the part of your brain that's actually asleep. Wake it up and go garden or go do an activity or contribute or help. And it just says it describes different ways to do that, but it's stimulating. And the fact is, part of you is at rest. So rest the tired part and work the rested part. Now, it's oversimplified, but that's what it says. Number 17 through 25, organize. It says, not everyone is born with the neatness gene, but it can be learned. The result is more time and space and energy to devote to those things that are important in life. By structuring our lives and by putting things in order, we are able to be a little more efficient. It doesn't reduce our responsibilities, but it gives us the ability to look at them a little more clearly and to process and do them a little more responsibly. You know, Paul to the Corinthians said, let everything be done decently and in order. Our lives, we should strive that they would be lived decently and in order. We should live in decency and order as much as we possibly can. Now that's a battle. We have a basement, it's storage, and it turns into a trash dump very quickly. Michelle and Don are down there yesterday, put it all back in order, organized, throw away all the good stuff, you know. But they put it back in order. Now you go on with your life, but you can actually find a light bulb now in our basement. So it doesn't take as long. And you'll multiply that in a different ways. But the magazine says, organize. Put your lives in order, and it will give you more time to do the things that are important. Numbers 26 through 46, like 21 of the points, said, get well. Get well. That's an interesting way to state it. They asked, are too many people squandering their most precious resource? And they're talking about their health, squandering it. It says you can feel better, maybe even live longer. And it went through and said 21 ways to consider addressing issues of health so that we do not squander the resources we have in that way. Proverbs 3 and verse number 1. My son, do not forget my law. Let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. Because the law is a boundary which puts order into our lives and tells us what the limits are. It's a fence that tells us where the pasture is, where we should feed, and which we should stay inside. And by getting out of the fence, it is a dangerous place. There are wolves and bears and lions out there. So it says, keep the law, it will bless you and do you well. Verse 7, do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and depart from evil. It'll be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. So there is a very dramatic and specific spiritual response to those things. And the last few points on their list, number 47 through 50, was take stock. And the question asked was this, is this the life you want? Is this what you want to be doing? Is this what you value? And the point was, it's easy to get wrapped up. It's so easy to get wrapped up in daily stresses that we forget to step back and reassess what we're doing. To stop and say, okay, maybe I'm off track. Maybe this isn't what I really want. Maybe I haven't done what I needed to have done. You know, John Bernard drives way in the back of that truck looking in the battleship Arizona blows up and he's alive and they're not. You think that doesn't go through your mind and say, you know, I wonder. I think tomorrow I'm going to be real careful about what it is I choose to do and real careful about what it is I avoid. I know that happened to me when I was in Vietnam. When one thing blows up and something else blows up, somebody else shoots at you and eventually you end up in the hospital, but after about 4 incidents and you're still okay, then at some point you say, you know, I think life maybe has a purpose. And it probably isn't the way I have been fulfilling it. You know, there has to be more benefit than being able to see how much you can drink and not fall on your face. There's got to be something more substantial than that. Is this the life you want? It's easy to get wrapped up in all the daily stresses and obligations and demands and forget to stop and look around and assess just exactly what it is that you value and what it is you are in pursuit of. How ready are we? Can we assess that? And if we're not ready, then why? What is it that holds us back? God doesn't hold us back. Do we hold ourselves back? Do we have the wrong priorities? Are we lost in our focus? Are we just wandering on our way? I'm sorry, but that doesn't pay off. What pays off is doing what God says to do and doing it right. It doesn't pay off because you know to do it. It pays off because you did it. I don't want the belayer thinking about what he's doing. I want him doing it. I'm not saying it's mindless. I'm just saying, no, I want the action. And then I am safe. How ready are we? Everybody doesn't get to finish what they're doing. We should not be taking that chance. We should not be imagining that time goes on forever, that the obligation will always be in the future, that there will always be time to do one more thing. Maybe there will be, but maybe there won't. We need to look at our lives and say, I am doing what I need to do at this point. And if God was to take my life, call my chip in, if my options were to finish, then yes, today, if my life was over, then as much as I could in the weakness of this flesh, I am doing and I have done what needed to be done. You don't always get to start over. How ready are we today?